All right. Welcome to Bible Over Brews News. I had a tagline for this. What was it again?
Oh.
Hold on.
All the news you can bruise? No, it wasn't that.
Good. That's good, too. That's pretty good.
Something with headlines.
It is. With headlines. It's
headlines and end times.
Yes.
That's
something.
It. He's got it. Yeah. That's
headline,
it. Headlines and end times. Keith got it. So.
Apparently we're not doing enough news.
Here I am. Eric Kuchus for Verka with Keith, who's got the header.
Woo!
And Gumby.
Hey, what's up?
And we are bringing a couple of whimsical stories to you tonight. We are not going to be serious. These are fun stories, except for Keith's.
Yeah, they're really serious.
A kitten died. Nice. A kitten died on Keith's. So,
well, they're serious subjects. I don't know if we'll be serious about them.
No, there we go. We're gonna make sure we drink something before we get to the serious ones, which will help a lot.
So, on that, we've got Guinness.
Expert segue.
Why? Because it was just St. Patty's Day. And we all need a Guinness when it comes to St. Patty's Day. Guinness was founded in 1759 when Arthur Guinness bought a small brewery in Dublin. At first, the brewery produced a variety of ales and beers, but in 1799, it was decided to concentrate exclusively on porter, a dark beer with a rich head. The beer later became known as stout and came to be regarded as the national beer of Ireland. By the 20th century, Guinness was the world's largest brewery and a renowned international brand. Here we go. Look at that creamy mixture. Mm. You know,
I know we've had this on before.
Oh, right. Once or twice.
Specifically for our last St. Patty's.
I was going to say.
Yep. We delve into that history.
Absolutely. This is, I would say, I think it's almost every St. Patty's Day that we have one of these for good measure. Maybe next year what we'll do is we'll try some of their other varieties. Yeah. Because.
Out of the bottle. There's a reason why they do that.
I have to say the dark, smoky flavor pairs well with secondhand smoke.
It does pair. Yes, we have good cigars too tonight.
Gumby was so kind as to bring along these beautiful, lovely 82 Mile from Cousins cigars. Mm. And this is their house brand, hand rolled in Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Mile 82.
Mm-hmm. Back to the beer for a minute. Are there any other dark stouts that have an ABV as low as 5.6. That's remarkable, I think.
So the cool thing about Guinness, and that's why it's very drinkable, is that it does have the lower ABV. And that's why it's easy to drink almost nightly if you're Irish.
I mean, I like my 10% stout that gets me drunk on two sips, but I got to respect the game here.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, and they did studies in the past where they did find nutritional properties inside the Guinness beer. So their claim to fame back in the 1930s and 40s was justified that there is some actual medicinal qualities to this. So there you go.
Like all beer or just Guinness?
Guinness in particular, all beer actually does have some nutritional properties, but they actually paid for their study.
See, it's a health drink.
So it's totally objective.
To our health, fellas.
To our health.
I am.
Cheers. By the way, Guinness commissioned a study in 2000 which found that an estimated 162,719 pints of Irish stout go to waste every year via facial hair.
What?
According to scientists, 0.52 milliliters of Guinness is trapped in a beard or mustache with each sip, and it was about 10 sips to finish a pint.
Oh my gosh.
That's amazing.
Look at all that waste. That's alcohol abuse.
All the statistics we concern ourselves day in and day out, and this one was just sitting right there.
Yep.
And I want more of that. I want more studies about what gets trapped in people's beards.
Yep.
Hams.
Loose change.
Small animals.
Right. 5-layer nacho dip.
Another sock.
Keith, what do you have for us?
All right. Kicking off with a quick take here. So we are recording from a pre-Trump has been arrested reality, if he's been arrested. I pray that wherever you're listening this, that he's either been arrested or not arrested. I honestly don't care anymore. I just want the DA to get crap or get off the pot. But I don't really want to talk about former guy, but I want to throw out my proposal for how to fix this nation and see what you guys think.
Okay. I'm interested.
When we talk about politicians and when they do bad stuff that would get normal people arrested, we're always like, oh, you can't arrest a sitting president. Oh, it's the process can be too political. You're not getting impartial jury. And then what happens is the guy never does any time. So my proposal is to fix this. Since most politicians are crooks, we err on the side of caution. And if you get elected to office, you have to serve time. Once you are out of office, and we can make this, we can vary it based on the level of office. Like, you know, city council person, you get like a weekend in the slammer. Like president, you get like a year after a 4-year term. And maybe you can delay it if you get elected a second time. And maybe if you're like a senator and you can keep getting elected, like there's no term limits. Maybe after like 2 terms, you have to start to serve time while like Congress is out. But like, I think this is the perfect solution because like, if you're president, you're going to do some illegal crap. So as a precautionary measure, we should send you to prison for a while.
I'm glad you said that.
So start the reform early.
I'm glad we cleared the table there. Let's get it out there.
Which, by the way, Trump's a billionaire, so I don't see him spending any time in jail.
Nor do I see him really doing anything wrong to get where he was at.
I'm going to let that one go.
Oh, man. I wish.
I was going to see how long the awkward silence lasted.
I wish audio podcasts could record eyes.
Choked on a cigar.
We tried so long to hold serious faces.
Well, if that rule were in effect, we could almost count Bill Clinton as having served time, having to be married to Hillary that whole time.
That's valid.
So all right. You're good, Bill Clinton. You don't worry.
And to be clear, I would not be partisan with this. I want the Democratic presidents to serve as much time as the Republicans. I want it to be a totally level playing field. You go to the White House, you leave the White House, you go to jail.
Yeah.
That's the way it should be.
Well, that's fair.
We're not talking nursing homes. I like the idea.
But thank again, you. There are some nursing homes that are worse than prisons, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
You know, conversely, I was thinking, though, if every politician had to go to jail at some point, like prison reform, like, that would become a real thing. Like, prisons would get real nice real fast. Like, any of those, like, subhuman conditions, like, they talked about in our county and really around the nation, gone. Absolutely gone.
It's true.
I don't know how much truth there is to it, but there was always a lot of rumors in the past about when the mafia had to serve time, the really higher mafia bosses had very cushiony prisons, very specific prisons that they'd go to and still ate lobster every night.
I have heard.
So I don't know how much of that is true. I want to say, no, that's all lies, but I don't know.
I knew a brother of somebody who spent federal time in federal prison. He would validate your claim.
So you made me think of a flaw in my plan, which is like, okay, say you're a senator, you're one-term senator, you go spend your 6 month in jail, whatever we decide the term is. You come out and maybe you run for another office, or maybe you run for president. Like, a bunch of like of the executive office, I bet, is going to be former prison wardens. Like, prison wardens in non-elected government offices go up 7,000% after my plan's in effect. Because how do you get that lobster? What do you have to offer?
Connections.
Anyway, that's enough about that, probably.
Trade you my cigarettes for political votes.
Gumby has something about masked cows.
Is it my turn?
Bill Gates cows.
Uh-oh.
Sorry, I got you.
On the spot.
Bill Gates cows should have caught everybody off guard. I don't know.
And in other news, this is from The Defender. That is Kennedy's website, or yeah, his program. Smart masks for cows. Gates invests $4.7 million in data, collecting face wear for livestock. I won't read you the whole article. I'll just give you a summary here. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation this month awarded a $4.8 million grant to a company that sells smart, quote-unquote, face masks for cows. ZELP, Z-E-L-P.
Love the name.
Which stands for Zero Emissions Livestock Project. Claims its artificial intelligence, AI, mass technology for livestock, will reduce methane emissions, considered to be a main greenhouse gas, and curb climate change. Cows and other ruminant animals emit methane in the process of digesting their food. This mask goes around the cow's head and captures the methane gas exhaled by the animal, oxidizing it and then releasing it into the air as carbon dioxide and water vapor, according to ZELP. It also has sensors continuously collecting millions of data points on the animals that are processed by the machine learning algorithms. Our AI is trained to detect heat and flag welfare conditions and identify the most efficient animals with high levels of accuracy. They're looking for the efficient animals. But critics, including third-generation farmer Howard Vlieger, I don't know if I said that right, said the Gates-funded venture is illogical and driven by greed. Vlieger, who advises crop and livestock farmers across the U.S., said, "This is what you would get when you combine greed and stupidity." Commenting on the news, Will Harris, a fourth-generation regenerative farmer who runs his family's farm, White Oak Pastures, told The Defender all he could say was, "Surely this is a hoax." But it is not. You can't make this stuff up. And there's more to the article, but I love some of the comments. I'll just read a couple of the comments at the bottom. Someone should put, this is the top one, someone should put a mask on Gates' face. and then another person commented on that one and said, and then put him on a diet of GMO corn while being injected with every vaccine on the childhood schedule. Ouch. And there's more stuff, but.
So this just shattered my perception of cows and methane. I know everybody I'm sure thinks about that all the time, but. Like,
constantly.
I hear it
constantly.
Cows, digestion, methane, and pollution. And I think of methane coming out of their butts in the form of farts. But no, the mask is going on their face. Like, I did not ever think of this.
So I would say that this is a waste. And here's why. And I do understand that this is actually a real problem. Not as maybe high as they say it is, but there is a problem with methane and livestock. And here's how it is. It's not because they just fart, all right? That's a little ridiculous. It's because you get these giant lagoons of nothing but crap and piss. Mm. And they are like acres long. These things are huge. These are, acres and acres long, sometimes up to a mile in length. And it's filled with nothing but, I mean, there, people die in these. When you slip in, you can't swim out. You just sink.
Yeah.
I mean, they're bad. So when it comes to this, that's not going to help.
It's not going to fix big industry, big agriculture. No. We need to tackle that as a separate issue. A lot of people feel that, you know, who are judging Bill Gates for this, and I would be one of them, be like, get your hands off the food industry. Get your hands off pharmaceutical stuff.
Honestly, retire.
Right. Stop trying to control things and quote-unquote
philanthropy. See, Aaron, I thought you were going to tell us not to eat meat.
That was coming next. Well, that honestly is a bigger problem than people realize. So the meat industry has been beefing up things like extra-normously. I'll put it to this way. Right now, you're losing about 20,000 acres a day in down in South America near the rainforest. So we're losing 20,000 acres of rainforest a day for cattle. So not only do you have a growing number of manure lagoons, but they're chopping down rainforest. So you are now losing what's producing your oxygen, and you're producing so much more methane. So we are causing an extraordinary harm to not just to the planet, but to our ecosystem, just so people can eat more burgers every day. And I'm sorry, it's not justifiable when there are legitimate ways to balance your diet without eating 3 hamburgers a day. I mean, before the 70s, the average American ate 8 ounces of beef a week. A week. That's 3 times a day now. So, and mind you, our population has gone up. So we're eating an extraordinary amount of meat these days, more so than humans have ever ate before. And we're suffering for it. And we're chopping down huge amounts of forest for it. And pretty soon we're not going to have a rainforest. I mean, that's just, they're blowing it away. So.
Yeah, honestly, this meat eater's largely on board with that. Like, I don't need to eat meat that often. I don't think anybody does. To the extent that we need to eat meat, like, it's actually good to have a meal without meat from time to time.
Yeah.
And the meat substitutes are already getting so good that I'm really excited when we have, like, the official, like, fully, like, synthetic, like, it's actual meat, but it's made in a lab somewhere. I'm actually kind of excited about that because, I mean,
whoa.
Like,
oh, you're right.
Butchering animals is kind of a pain in the butt. Like, I mean, I don't have to deal with it, but every time, like, you know, my wife buys, like, one of those, like, full, like, chickens that you roast and then, like, I have to pick the whole thing apart, and then nobody eats the leftovers, and then I'm sitting here like pulling bones out of my teeth because I feel bad about these leftovers. I mean, I don't need that.
Well, not only that, but you're not eating a chicken. You're eating a large chick because they fill them with growth hormones and steroids, and so within weeks, that thing goes from here to here. I mean, if you look at 100 years ago, a chicken was a chicken. It looked like a regular skinny bird. And now they're just these giant fat things that can't even walk.
Yeah, you can still get that. It's a matter of convenience. My mother gets it. She's 81.
Yeah, but
she has a farm that she goes to, and she picks it up.
Yeah.
And she doesn't have to deal with all... I think the problem that he feels like he's addressing here with this... I mean, big agriculture is a problem, right? Monsanto, et cetera, et cetera, right?
Oh, yeah.
All of those people, they're a problem, but this is not a way to tackle the problem.
No.
Not to mention with AI technology on cows, there's other risks for the animals, like radiation, tumors, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever other ill effects that are not meant for cows. So anyways, that's that one.
We real quick though, we didn't talk about the elephant in the room on this one.
Mm-hmm.
So how much money do you said? For, he invested $4.7 million?
Yeah.
So, okay. I don't remember exactly how much Bill Gates is worth, but I'm pretty sure Bill Gates does not make a personal decision to invest $4.7 million of his own money. Like, that had to have been a low-level staffer.
Are you kidding me? Yeah. It's probably reading this like, I did what?
Right?
Linda, I knew I should have never divorced you. She's getting back at him.
Oh, that would be the ultimate troll. She invested money on cowbats under his name. Oh, that would be epic.
That would be the best troll.
I mean, is she still part of the Gates Foundation? She might be.
Oh,
really? Yeah, dang. Yeah. There you go.
Kidding me.
Oh, man. She could totally F with him all the time. That's so good.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love it.
You're going to rock over there with Epstein. I'll show you.
Revenge is silent and sweet.
Vindictive.
All right, so ready to drop the heavy? We've had
drop
a little beer.
Heavy, go ahead.
All right, so we have a headline from the National Catholic Register. Yes, I picked one from the Register, not the Reporter. I'm like not living up to my liberal bona fides here. Wisconsin priest, actually though, it links to a Reporter article. Wisconsin priest stripped of faculty to hear confessions after he advocated violating that. That headline sucks. Violating the sacrament, violating the seal of confession in sex abuse cases. So The Archbishop of Milwaukee has stripped one of his priests of the faculty to hear confessions following the clergyman's public support for civil laws mandating that priests break the seal for sins of sexual abuse. So if someone goes in and confesses, I sexually abused a minor, he would say that, I would support laws that would say that that priest, even in that situation, is a mandatory reporter, like a lot of folks are in inside of confessional situations, like teachers and maybe even other folks like religious instructors in other contexts.
Yeah.
So Father James Connell has been informed. In fact, like, and really all he was doing was he was commenting on an article about a proposed law in Delaware to, force priests to break the seal of confession in this particular situation. So the Archbishop has informed Father James Connell that effective immediately he's to cease all such erroneous communications and also to stop hearing confessions. This priest is a canon lawyer who has been outspoken about this for years before. And actually there was an article in the National Catholic Reporter. He wrote about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, where he laid out his case for this, which I did not put in my wrong note. There we go.
When you say break the seal, does that mean if they confess something to you that could be illegal in any way, you can report it to the authorities? Is that what that means?
So they're saying the law would say in the particular case, if someone confesses sexually abusing a minor, mm-hmm. that they would, that the priest would be a reporter, not for any other sins, even like murder or anything like that. The law that the law that's being proposed would only say for that particular violation of the law.
Be a reporter.
Right. Yeah. That the priest would not be able to keep that a secret legally. The priest would have to tell the authorities. So the seal of confession has been a longstanding, but whereas we're going to discuss here is maybe not an always standing principle of Catholic confessional theology, and has thus been protected by law. It has been affirmed by the Supreme Court in the past that, priests are allowed to not violate the seal of confession, as they call it, which the seal means is that, like, everything you say in confession stays in confession. It's the Vegas law. In the original article that he wrote in the Reporter, the priest report in the Reporter, supporting this, he wrote, I realize there's some people who hold that the seal of confession is a matter of divine law, having been intended by the Lord in the establishment of the sacrament of reconciliation, and thus cannot be changed. However, if it were so, why did the Holy Spirit allow the church to employ public penances over the first centuries? So he lays out in this article how early on, of like really serious sins, your penance was carried out in public. Like, you would go before kind of like, self-flagellating or whatever. Maybe you wouldn't be allowed to be inside the church for X number of years for this sin or whatever. I think they actually had pretty precise, like, you had to do this for this number of years based on this sin. He continues, I respond, because the seal is not a matter of divine law. And this is why he says that, because it was not always done by the church. And he says, the change is needed. To do so, we must distinguish confidentiality that is intended by the Almighty for the common good of human life from the statute of secrecy or seal that was established by church authority. Unquestionably, secrets have a proper place in our lives. At times, governments need secrets, businesses need secrets, families need secrets, individuals need secrets, and even the church needs secrets. Yet, if secrets contribute to the endangering of minors and vulnerable adults to be preyed on by sexual abuse, that form of secrecy is immoral and perhaps illegal. So that's his case. He's saying we haven't always done it, and because of the stakes, and especially not just because of the stakes in those individual cases, but because this has been a problem in the church in the past, maybe we shouldn't do it. Maybe we shouldn't keep the secret.
Wow. Let's go back to talking about cows.
That is a hard one, because the seal of confession has it's been sacred for so long, mm-hmm. and there's been some fantastic testimonies over it. There's one. So there was actually a spy that came in from Russia, and he came in to try to bring down the Catholic Church. And it turns out he was one of a bunch of them that came over.
Russians.
He came over from Russia, and there was several of them that were working through their education. Right? They were all priests in training. Okay. And he went to confession and he confessed this. And a year later, when the priest had not turned him in and hadn't told anybody, it so hit him in his soul that not only did he become a full-blown priest, but now he's still to this day, still alive. To this day, he still goes around the country telling people about what he was supposed to do and why he doesn't do it. So, but he was sent in as an agent to try to destabilize the Catholic Church.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That is fascinating. And I could see, as the only one here not Catholic, certainly understand the value, not even just in regards to tradition, but the importance of keeping something sacred. I get it. Totally get it. Totally respect it. You know, I think your point kind of show the value of that. Yeah, but this, I don't know. It's such a sticky subject.
Very.
And I think that's so, like, I would, in our current legal climate, and really any legal climate throughout history, I think I would be leery of a blanket, like, oh, if somebody reports breaking a law in confession, that you must report them. That could be so easily abused. We already know that law enforcement, like, certain laws get enforced, certain laws don't get enforced, certain laws get enforced against certain people, and they don't get enforced about other certain people.
Yeah.
The situation about, like, sexual abuse, like, in the church is one where there hasn't, like, the extra vigilance is justified based on, like, what her experience has been, you know, in the past 50, 60 years. So I'm, like, especially considering, like, yes, it's old, like, it's been in place, the seal of confession has been in place since at least, like, the 12th century, I think I read, but it hasn't always been in place. The Holy Spirit has not always led the church, if that's who's pulling the strings, truly, to have a blanket seal of confession for everything. So I think he has a fair point in that respect.
Yep.
And given the current crisis, I think it's fair to say that, hey, maybe, like, this particular one, if you confess that, we got to tell somebody. I think this is also an interesting thing because, like, this sounds like it's a Catholic thing, like it's Catholic inside baseball. Mm-hmm. It's really not. Even though other churches,
Catholic and baseball.
Even though other churches don't have, yeah, like most other churches don't have like an actual like private confession, they do have their processes, whether they're like very planned out or they're like crisis mode, emergency, everybody get everybody together for dealing with these situations internally.
Yep.
And there is a lot of sense, like, I think, you know, I'm trying to think of other examples, but like the Josh Duggar one comes to mind where they find out Josh is engaging in sexual abuse of minors.
Yeah.
And it's the dad and, you know, maybe some folks in the church. Eventually it's a policeman who's friendly to their church. And they're all just kind of like working on the side to be like, all right, we need to set Josh straight. His punishment ends up being going to like go do home construction with a friend for a while. So it's like, if you, I feel like there's a sense, whether you're Catholic or not, if you confess the sin inside the church and the church, and by church, we often mean like the pastor or like the people, the elders or whoever, the people in power, if they forgive you, then you've already been forgiven by a higher power than the state. And therefore, in a sense, you are kind of exonerated.
Hmm.
And I feel like even if you don't have a formal like law saying like, oh, a Catholic priest, you know, like the Catholic priest not having to violate the seal of confession may not necessarily apply to the Lutheran pastor or whoever, like it kind of can de facto apply. And we actually even see that in situations in our legal, you know, realm where it has been, you know, exceptions have been carved out for clergy in general to not be mandated reporters in certain pastoral situations.
Mm-hmm.
So like the more leeway that the Catholic Church gets here with this very long standing tradition, the more leeway every church gets to basically not report sexual abuse of minors when it happens under their roof.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. A couple things. I've always, I've been on the record a few times here on our show to defend the Catholic Church in regards to this specific subject of sexual abuse. Because for whatever reason, which we'll probably touch on a little bit later with our media, they love to throw the Catholic Church in this regard specifically under the bus.
Yeah.
When there are so many other religions that are maybe worse. And so, but it just doesn't get talked about and that easily visible and thrown under the public's view. So that's one thing. But the other thing, when you talked about exoneration being, you know, kind of like spiritually exonerated, I certainly am in line with that. And I can see that as being a authentic thing for the person to be exonerated spiritually. If you're forgiven, the church forgave you, you're whatever. I don't know if I would say that that doesn't mean you shouldn't have
repercussions.
Yeah.
Oh, I agree with you. I'm just saying, I think when it comes up in practice, sometimes people are tempted to see it that way because it involves less trouble for everybody.
Exactly. Yep. And so I would say, you know, maybe for the priest in the Catholic Church and all of them, maybe there should be some type of training in that, hey, you know, when it comes to these specific subjects, X, Y, Z, whatever they are, whatever they may be, you need to really push hard back on this person and say, you are forgiven. You're a child of God. You did wrong. Now you need to go make it right with these people and their family.
There are some priests who do that. There are some priests who, when you do something, part of your penance is to make something else right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that.
There's a lot of priests who forget what you're talking about halfway through. And that one sin, maybe you should have done penance towards the other person. And the first sin you talked about, and then the 10th sin you got to, would be like, oh, that's just a Hail Mary, Our Father thing when you're done.
Yeah,
go for go pray three Hail Marys.
And to your point earlier, I was listening to an Irish priest, and he was making that point. He said, "Listen, in the earlier parts of the church, you're lucky now because back then, if you were a repeat offender, let's say I forgive you of your sins, and you come back and you're repeating your sin again, you were required to now perform your confession in front of everybody."
I was going to say, the old snippety snips coming.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Which may be what's necessary. But, you know, to your point, in other other faiths, I hate that saying other faith. I mean, it's all Christianity to me. But, you know, on the Protestant side of things, I do have a similar story. And I won't, because it's very recent. It's with people I know. But I would just say this. A youth pastor got in trouble with some of the youth. The head pastor I've known for a long time, and the council from, I won't even say the denomination right now, because it's a fresh thing.
Okay.
Encouraged, look, deal with him privately.
Yeah.
And it was the worst thing that they did.
Really?
It blew up. And that's where I hear, you know, everything that happens in the dark will be exposed in the light.
Yeah.
No matter the process, no matter the tradition, and it just the youth pastor serving time.
Okay.
Dang.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm glad he's serving time for stuff he did.
Yeah.
But like that process, that's such a mess.
Yeah.
But who knows how the process may have looked if from the beginning everything was dealt with out in the open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't know. Yeah. I mean, maybe he still would have to serve time. He most certainly would have a record, which I think is justifiable. But it couldn't look different, you know.
It's like in both cases he's got a record, but in one, you know, the case where you have it on the open, a bunch of other people, like in the church as a whole, doesn't lose the credibility that they lose by hiding it first.
Exactly. Right.
And which drives people away.
Exactly.
And
100%.
Yeah. Yeah. Luckily the church has got pretty good about dealing with it now. And they do have a lot of people facing ramifications. So
I have a proposal here, because part of this situation is the church is doing, because we've been loosey-goosey about what confession is and what confession isn't.
Judging by what you said earlier, I'm going to guess that you're going to say that if you become a priest, you automatically have to go to prison?
Close, but no cigar, pun intended. So confession, there's been like... A classic thing you'll hear is that you're supposed to confess your sins in number and in kind. Like it could be as simple as I sinned against the, you know, fifth commandment three times or whatever. But like reality is like, there's also like this loosey goosey. Well, like, okay, you have to go to confession for mortal sins, venial sins, which, you know, for anybody who doesn't know that distinction is like stuff where like maybe you didn't intend to do it, even though it's a sin, or you didn't know it was a sin and you did it and then you found out later, that kind of thing. Like not the thing where you like fully knew what was going on. You know, those are saying that like, oh, venial sins are forgiven through receiving the Eucharist at Mass. But some priests will say, oh, you should go confess venial sins anyway. And if you're not aware of yourself confessing a mortal sin, there's also a requirement that you go to confession at least once a year during Lent.
Yep.
So you're in this like weird, like, if you think too hard about it, you're like, what do I confess? How much detail? Good. Like, and then you're worried, like, if I don't give enough detail, is you going to assume this a mortal sin when it really was a venial sin? So then I have to describe more of exactly what's going on. And then maybe the priest is one of those ones who asks a bunch of questions. And then maybe you eventually get to the point where like, oh, this is kind of like therapy. And I'm going to be the person that sits in the confessional for 25 minutes. And everybody in the line behind you is really angry because you're like, why can't I get in? There's only 5 minutes left in the confession time. And I need to get in there and just spit out my sins and get out. And this person is just hogging the priest.
Is that actually happened? Yeah, I mean, there's the
most sinning occurs when you're thinking bad thoughts in the confession line about that person who's taken too long in confession. So
that's amazing.
So there's a restaurant, local restaurant here. Messing my proposal. There's a local restaurant here. You guys have all been to the Happy Dog, right?
I don't think I have.
Brook Park.
Which one?
On Brook Park?
No, on Lorraine. No. I'm sorry, Detroit.
No.
Oh my gosh, you guys haven't been the hot Happy Dog?
No.
I mean, if the acoustics weren't awful, I'd say we should record there. But we should go to the Happy Dog anyway sometime. Okay. So the Happy Dog is this wonderful restaurant, and the menu is they give you like a golf pencil and this little paper menu, and you check off what you want. And what they do at their specialty at the Happy Dog is they have like 70 different things you could put on a hot dog, and they miraculously make it all work. If you're like, I want sriracha, Fruit Loops, deviled egg, kimchi. I'm trying to think of other weird things. I don't know, brown sugar, whatever. Like, and 17 other things, and you want that all in your hot dog, you just check it off on this little thing with your golf pencil, and they bring it out in 10 minutes, and it's amazing. So my proposal to get back to like the standardized, like number and in kind, and nobody has like any second guessing about what they're supposed to do in confession and what they're not supposed to do.
Okay.
Is you have the Happy Dog menu, but for sins. And it's basically like first commandment, second commandment, third commandment, whatever. And you just say like, put a 3 next to the sixth commandment if you thought lustful thoughts 3 times or whatever. And then you hand it to the priest and the priest does the absolution and you're done. And what this solves is, number one, everybody knows what to do in confession. They're confessing all their sins in number and kind, just like the good people on Catholic Answers or whatever told me to. And nothing on that can be construed as an admission of a guilt of a federal, state, local crime.
Okay.
So then, of course, if somebody says in the confession, oh, yeah, I abused a kid, they violate the menu and blurt that out loud. Oh, yeah, it's easy. You're a mandatory reporter. That wasn't on the menu.
There you go.
So that's my proposal.
Okay. It's funny you say it. So with my kids, that's actually how I taught them to do confession.
Oh, interesting.
To examine their conscience and then think of the 7 commandments and then confess to one of those sins that aligns with what they think is that sin. So.
See, like, it's like a formulaic way to do it. Cause it's like, what do you tell? Like, and plus two, when you start saying stuff, like depending on like who you are or what you're saying, like I've read too many stories on Twitter of women going in there and confessing a sexual sin and the priest is starting to ask details and they're like creeped out. Like this has happened more than once, just sure, like my limited visibility. Like, right. Wow, like gotta avoid that. Like you can't be sending folks into a situation where they might be like traumatized by it. So it's like.
So in this case, the bishop, you said, took this privilege away from this priest to hear confessions.
Yeah, this priest can't hear confessions.
So is that kind of like, is that sanctioned by the Vatican? Is that like, that's,
I don't think it needs to be. I think the bishop can just say, hey, a priest in my diocese can't say confessions.
Yeah,
that's another like smaller point that I think, like, this, regardless of whether you agree with it or not, this priest seems like a sincere enough person that he wouldn't violate the church law in the confessional. So like there isn't, I don't think there's a really a danger in him continuing to hear confessions. So that feels like a little bit extreme by the diocese. I get the impulse. You're like, oh, this guy said something. He didn't toe the party line here. I'm going to take away his ability to do this. But like, I feel like there isn't actually a risk of him like violating the seal of confession. Like he's advocating something outside of how he's doing it, I feel like. Granted, I don't know the guy, but I don't know. He's putting himself on a serious limb by talking about this at all.
Yeah, I'd really like to know what the bishop's was behind that and why they would do it. I mean, what's your thought, Aaron? Do you think it should... Yes or no? It seems like either it's one option or the other right now.
I think that this needs to be something that the bishops come together and speak on. That's, you know, we have a United Council of Bishops across the U.S. So I think that if this is to progress to the next level, I think that this, they should form a synod and then speak about that.
And I mean, are you worried that it's a slippery slope?
I think, depending on how it goes, yes, it could be. But if handled the right way, then I think it would be fine, you know. And to their credit, I've liked the decisions that the bishops have made for the most part, you know, united. I know Keith probably disagrees. But for the most part, I like what the bishops have done. Their conciliar efforts have been, for the most part, conciliar. So... there's been onesie twosies, but I think for the most part they've done the best they can in their situations.
I have questions about that $25 million party they're throwing in Indianapolis in a few years, but that's another matter.
It just kind of seems like a no brainer, you know, if I was a priest, that if I found out something that was physically hurting someone, whether it was a child or a spouse or just whatever, if you're physically causing harm to someone, that
I do think there's a non-trivial number of bishops who are still like under the impression of like, if there is an accusation, like the default stance is like that accusation is like unfair and like they're probably lying. I bet there's a non-trivial number of bishops who are still under that, even though we have abundant evidence that people who report abuse on the vast majority of times are telling the truth.
Mm. But that is a good point. That's a real good point. Mm-hmm. Because how would a priest actually know that that's actually happening?
Right.
Right, yeah. And that's where the authorities are supposed to come into play.
It's a touchy subject. It's it's a slippery slope. It's all of the above.
Well, because of course the Catholic Church critics would say, well, the priests are only doing that because, like you said, because of the history of the, you know, the sexual scandals in the Catholic Church, so they don't want to let anything get out.
Yeah. And I could see where they would say that. And then, but... then that, of course, we've talked about that before, where there's a lot of that across all of the different faith branches and religions. And so,
And within the CMA church on a Protestant side, one of the biggest theologians ever, Ravi Zacharias, the man was literally the Christian version of Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah.
Probably worse, because Ravi Zacharias literally wrote theology books and all of that that our denomination studied after to become a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he was like this womanizer / trafficker.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. That when that hit, that was
it
something
shook
else.
Our denomination. Yeah. They actually had to meet together, you know, aggregate and talk about it. Like it was, what the heck do we do?
Yeah. He was the face.
Yes. Brilliant man. No doubt.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I still got a few of his books.
I mean, that kind of stuff, really, like when we talk about like critics of the Catholic Church, like the critics who would be like, hey, you have ulterior motives for not breaking the seal in this case would be the critics who are like outside of American Christendom in general. Like if this Delaware law were to pass and it were to go to the Supreme Court and people were filing amicus briefs to, you know, be in support or opposition to it, like every mainstream evangelical group would be in support of the seal confession because they would see the writing on the wall that If there's a law that passes that says you have to break the seal of confession, there's going to be laws that further govern how pastors operate in private situations across all of Christianity in America.
So you would say like the more traditional Catholics would view that as like too progressive, this happening?
Oh, absolutely.
Too left-leaning or whatever?
I mean, I would say even like this is one of those issues that actually like normie Catholics would probably still say, oh, don't break the seal. Just because it's like been around so long.
Wow, that's pretty wild.
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
I would challenge any conservative on our side, on that for sure. And I consider myself conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's not like the people who are like going, you know, talking to like the American Center for Law and Justice and like working on amicus briefs. Like they're not the majority of even conservatives in Catholic or evangelical churches. It's like really a few people at the top who are kind of like dictating the policy for everybody, yeah. Which is a whole other topic.
Right.
yeah, definitely.
We should have stuck with masks and cows.
Ready for one more?
Oh, boy.
All right.
Where are you heading now?
All right. We are heading, this is a church, I think in Washington, called Church Home, except they don't put an extra H. So it's like, looks like Church Home, but I think it's pronounced Church Home.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of like Judah Smith? He looks really familiar. Like, look at this picture of this guy. Like, doesn't that guy look familiar? Like, he looks like.
Oh, he does look familiar.
Like a mega, I mean, he's a mega church pastor. Like, so that's kind of obvious, but he looks like one of those ones that's like, trying a little too hard to be like both geeky and cool. I don't know. I don't want to comment like too much on his appearance though, because I'd rather
maybe
talk
it works.
About
I don't know.
The class action lawsuit against his church filed on behalf of any current or former employees of the church that want to join the class action suit for violating Washington state law by requiring that their employees tithe 10% of their wages from the church. So literally what would happen is they would get paid by the church because they're employees, and the church would say, as part of your employment contract, you have to give 10% of the money back. And if they didn't get the 10% of the money back, there would be reprimands leading up to termination.
Wow.
So and they have a whole paper trail on the one particular employee with like all these like discussions about like, you know, she wouldn't be got behind in her rent. And the church is pestering her that you like, you really got to get tithing again. I mean, this really brings up a whole thing though. This is one case, but there are a lot of cases about like extra stipulations in, employment contracts for religious employers.
It's what God wants.
And it's like this really big question of like, how far can a religious employer go in mandating your religious practice? The kind of classic example that I don't even need to give a particular example of is it's been pretty frequent in Catholic schools where if a teacher comes out as gay and is married to a partner of the same sex, then they get fired. And as like Father James Martin is always pointing out, is like, we always fire teachers for that sin, quote unquote, but we like there's all the other teachers are probably sinning too, and we don't investigate that, let alone fire them. Another classic example has come up in recent years is Dave Ramsey's company, who's actually like way bigger than I thought. Like they have a lot
he's
of products.
Huge.
But he's been known for having very strict employment regulations, including. There was an employee who announced that she was pregnant on Facebook. She was not married, and she got fired for that.
Oh.
And a quote from Dave Ramsey. I'm not sure where they got this quote, because this is awfully frank, but Dave Ramsey is a pretty frank guy. Mm-hmm. But he said, "We have a moral code of conduct at our office. I fire people if they have extramarital affairs. The hilarious thing is I put that on Twitter, and people go, 'Won't you get sued for that?' No. You're allowed to discriminate against infidelity. I've got a right to tell my employers whatever I want to tell them. They freaking work for me. This is an employment at will state, which means if I decide I don't like people with green eyes, I don't have to hire you. I don't have to keep you anymore. There's no eye color discrimination laws. Sorry."
No, that does sound like Dave Ramsey.
I was trying to channel a little bit. It's been a while since I can't get the accent, but I feel like I can get the demeanor, you know?
It does sound. He's so. I go back and forth with him because some of his advice is really good.
Yeah, it is.
But then I disagree with other advice that he has too. So even financially, there are some things that he says I disagree with. In fact, recently, I don't know if you caught this, but recently he got in trouble because, so I'm sure you've heard of this timeshare thing, right? and to his credit, he speaks against timeshares. Now you should not be part of them, right? But there's a company that he's always referring to help you get out of them. Well, it turns out this second company does sort of buy you out of the timeshares, but you kind of then owe them the timeshare money. So
oh my God.
It's kind of a catch-22. And he recently got into a huge scandal on this, because then they went under, and then they were still owed. And it was, oh, is it, yeah, it was this. It was this.
So basically, big, when you get in debt for buying his program, he's got a way out for you just in case.
Yes.
Go see his affiliate company.
That's right.
Who he sits on the board of, too, I'm sure.
Probably.
Funny. It's, yeah, that's just, it's corporatism, and it happens in the church.
Yeah.
You know, going back to what you were saying, I mean, yeah, that's the whole tithing. And you grew up evangelical, right? You were.
No, I had a phase in college.
Okay. man, well, as far as the AG goes, man, that's pretty much gospel. You can do without any of the gospels and still tithe and be all right. yeah, I think it's one of those things where I think it's been always taken out of context.
Okay.
Biblically. From the Old Testament. Do I think some of the principles are good around it? Yeah, I do. I mean,
yeah.
However you choose to decide to want to do that. But if from a spiritual standpoint, if what you're giving back to the church, you know, I think you're being forced to do it, don't give it.
I think this is the point.
Yeah, if I was the pastor and you were giving something to me begrudgingly because you felt pressured or guilty otherwise, or that you may be going to hell, I don't want your money.
Yeah.
Gosh, no. I say, if you're poor and you're struggling to pay your bills and all of that, you better take care of your home first.
Yeah.
That's how I feel.
Yeah. I mean, to his credit, like my priest, how many times I've heard him talk about tithing? Zero. I've never once ever heard him talk about tithing. Once a year, he'll bring up Catholic Charities because they do a ton of good work. But he brings it up once a year, and outside of that, I've never heard him talk about tithing.
But yeah.
But you remind me, though, is actually like, in this particular case, like what a explicit power move it was to make the request that way. Like if, say, you like this church hired people and just offered them wages that were lower than 10% what they would have normally offered them and pocketed that money, they would not have broken any laws.
Yeah.
And other than maybe having people like, oh, why am I paid more? They, you know, would have had no repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, it's like this like power move where you're like, no, I'm going to pay you this, but I'm going to make you pay this percent back.
Yeah.
Like.
That's fat. So I will say this, and not to try to defend the other side, but to kind of play devil's advocate a bit. You know, when you brought up the at-will employer, it is a very real thing, you know, or. No company is truly obligated to keep you, and nor are you obligated to just show up the next day. You can both just decide to terminate your contracts, right?
Yep.
So with certain denominations on the Protestant side, at least, I know, like with the AG or the CMA, that there are certain guidelines that they have to keep in order to be paid ministry, right? You cannot drink. You cannot smoke. You cannot publicly dance. And I'm sure you have to pay your tithes out of it. I'm sure that's one of the, you know, things you have to do in order to be a quote-unquote pastor within their denomination. And so I'm only saying that to say this, that they know this when they sign up. And they still sign up. So if this person didn't know something like that signing up, I don't think it's going to really stand much in court.
So this does bring up a very, like, so in this case, the case is in the state of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And Washington has explicitly a law against clawing back wages, at least in this manner.
Okay.
But this brings up an interesting point where it's like, there is a lot of leeway for employment regulations or employment contracts. And there is, of course, employment at will is our predominant form of whatever. So you violate the contract, you get fired, and your only recourse is maybe to sue in court if you have the resources to even do that. But this hits at when it comes to churches. So like basically, if it's a part of your state or federal employment law, okay, you can't violate that. But as a church or a religious, you know, organization, there have been certain exceptions granted. And so one of these key ones is the ministerial exception. And this has been actually like continuously widened by the Supreme Court in recent years.
Interesting.
And this hits at the whole like more like, oh, I'm going to fire the teacher for being in a lesbian relationship.
Mm.
So originally the ministerial exception was applied to like pastors basically, or people who are in an actual like religious teaching position. So basically it's saying like a church, if they hire a pastor, they can require that pastor to like believe what they're teaching and to teach things that are consistent with that faith.
Gotcha.
And so that exception has always been pretty much present.
Mm-hmm.
But in recent years, it's been expanded to like, basically the question before the court has been, who is a minister? First, it was a pastor. Then it was like extended to teachers. So like, and then extended to teachers beyond like theology. So this is where it comes up. It's like, well, if you are a math teacher in a Catholic school, you are technically representing the faith in this several things removed way, but this gives that Catholic school the right to fire you if you're a lesbian. Mm. And this is getting to the point now, like basically any religious liberty case that goes before our Supreme Court now, and you know, it's possible this case could get to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is happy to weigh in on many state cases that they want to weigh in on. We're getting to the point where the ministerial exception could apply to the janitor. Like if you know the janitor is having, you know, an extramarital relationship, you know, they're a minister in the way that they wash those floors in your school. So you, church school have the right to fire them.
Ouch.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. Wow. It does beg more questions, and there are problems with the at-will model. So,
well, going back to your earlier point about, you know, keeping things sacred and all of that, you know, at a certain point, I understand kind of both sides. I guess the conservative right, true traditionalists, even on the Protestant side, would say, hey, you know, we keep pushing it, we keep changing laws, and now no one has to do this, so anything kind of goes now. And then to the point where nothing's really sacred,
yeah,
you know, and anything kind of goes within the church. And so I can understand the fear. I think it's a little bit irrational. But yeah, I don't know what else to do. I mean, yeah. Just recently within, I know our specific denomination, and I won't say it, I probably already did and I shouldn't have. Anywho, pastors are now allowed to drink. It's okay if they drink, right?
Ooh, you can invite them on Bible Over Brews.
And, right. So I'm like, I don't think that's a bad thing, but a lot of people still do, you know, even within the top leadership, as well as in the church, you know, within the congregations,
I'm just saying, Jesus' first miracle was making wine.
Yeah, I get it. But then it's like, you know, all right, one domino down. How many more keep falling, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. At some point, lines have to be drawn.
Yeah. Yeah.
So speaking of lines, to bring this one home, I have a slightly ridiculous line.
Wait. We're not going to go with cocaine. No. That should still be illegal.
So this is from a job description for a, it's not a church, but it is a religious employer. They provide a religious ministry service.
Okay.
It's a job I am welcome qualified for. It's a front end software engineer. And this job in its listing, it's a very long listing, and it, you know, talks about basic job requirements and also talks about how, we ask that all of our employees pray at least 1 hour a day. But that's not the requirement I am bringing up. And Aaron might know who I'm talking about once I bring this one up. Their job description says, oh, and we ask all team members to take cold showers every day. If that sounds funny, well, it's not a joke.
Wait, so do they have showers on site?
No, just you have to take cold showers every day.
Oh.
Can you guess who this is?
This is escaping me. No.
Oh, dang. Exodus 90.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
So Exodus 90 is a men's spiritual 90-day program you often do in a group, and one of you do all these things where you like don't watch TV, you don't eat certain things every day, and you take cold showers every day. So as part of the condition of employment, at least according to this job description, I don't know what the actual contract looks like. I was tempted to go through the interview just to see what would happen because I am so well qualified. they are purportedly saying that, you know, they could be saying you have to take cold showers every day that you work at this place.
How do you prove that?
Maybe your wife signs off. I don't. Maybe you have to take a picture. I don't know how you take a. Yeah, just take a picture of the spigot before you.
The Lord knows.
So this is the question: should an employer be able to require an employee under the pain of threat of termination to take cold showers every day?
Maybe you sync your Apple Watch to it, or. See? That's cold water.
That's a question for ChatGPT. I'm going to go with no, but.
I mean, in athletics, we do it just for the athletic side, for the, you know, the healing benefits to the body. But
shower? I mean, I'll do a bath, like sometimes after a run.
You can do either one. Like a lot of times in athletics, what we'll do is you know, you go for your run, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then you take a warm to wash yourself off,
yeah,
and then you end with it cold for anywhere from 30 seconds up to like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
So
Gumby, are you saying you get out of the cold shower regulation by taking a warm bath? Because I was just going to say I wasn't going to shower anymore.
It's funny because, you know, there's always been a part of me that rebels. Like, I'll do that as a practice, right?
Yeah.
But the moment you tell me that my job becomes contingent upon it, it's like, oh, hell no.
hence Protestant.
Exactly.
I was actually going to briefly argue the devil's advocate on this one, because having gone through Exodus 90 once, although in a weird situation, one of the guys insisted that we do an Exodus 120, which was why I did not do Exodus 90 again. So the app leads you through the program, right? Purportedly. So if you're the app developer, to truly dog food, to truly beta test your app, you need to go through the whole program, right?
Okay.
And for continuous testing, you know, in software development, we talk about continuous integration being like always deploying. You know, that could result in order for you to properly continuously test your software amongst all the changes that come in at all the time, that you are never allowed to take a warm shower again.
Good fight, good night. Okay. Well, this was a good news episode. I'm glad we caught up with all the cow information.
Cow masks, all right? AI masks. You did right, buddy.
Respect the cow masks.
Cow masks and the anomalies of the faith.
Some cows are revolting, though. They're like, hell no, we won't wear masks.
It's bovine, right?
Right. We won't take away our rights to be slaughtered.
Bovine Protestants. All right. Well, Keith, last words.
Oh, I'm just going to, you know, wash off the cigar smoke with a cold shower when I'm done here. So.
Hey, Gumby.
There's nothing taboo over brew. It was fun.
Everyone, catch us on social media. We're going to start capping these off so I don't have to keep repeating over again. Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and don't forget, we're on all of your favorite podcast platforms.
And Patreon.
In fact, you can even donate to us on anchor.fm/BibleLoaf of Brews so that we can continue to bring you fantastic, great information and fulfill all of your needs for bovine and faithful anomalies. Good night.